Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Good morning to you from Charlottesville.
Right. So this week we're going to try to tackle three topics, and we're going to try to tie them all together if we can. The first, in some ways, is a continuation of our theme from last week's episode where we talked about Ralph Northam's yearbook page and blackface. He made a comment on CBS This Morning about the origins of slavery in the United States, or at least in Virginia, where he describes, this is the quote from CBS This Morning, 1619, the first indentured servants from Africa landed on our shores, a comment which has received a great deal of commentary in the past 48 hours. So we want to unpack that. A second story we want to tackle is Donald Trump's response to Elizabeth Warren's candidacy as president, in which he tweeted today, "Elizabeth Warren, sometimes referred to me by me as Pocahontas, joined the race for president. Will she run as our first Native American presidential candidate, or has she decided that after 32 years, this is not playing so well anymore? See you on the campaign trail, Liz." And the word trail there is capitalized, which many people have seen as being a reference to the Trail of Tears. So we want to unpack all of that. I think there's a lot there to work with. And finally, Ed, we're going to talk about an article in The New Yorker by Eric Alderman, The Decline of Historical Thinking, which was published in the February 4th issue of The New Yorker. And so I think we're going to see if we can find some ways to tie all three of these things together. Right.
And David, I think they do tie together, because I think to some extent this is all about engagement with history and, as Alterman's article suggests, historical thinking. So yes, and I think there's an issue about historical literacy, we might call it. So I think each of these is a dimension of that.
Oh, definitely. All right. So let's start off with Ralph Northam's comment on CBS This Morning. This was in response, of course, to his the continuing controversy over his yearbook page from medical school, which depicts a person in blackface and a person in the Klan outfit. If you want the full details and discussions of which, listen to our last episode. And he is talking about the origins of slavery in Virginia, and he mentions in 1619, and he describes them, the first Africans, as being indentured servants. Frank, you want to start to unpack this? First off, what's the deal with 1619?
Right. Okay. There's a lot to work with here, David. The first thing we should say, I think, is when we recorded last week's episode, we mentioned the Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax in passing. Really, in the past week, and as we were recording the episode, a second scandal was unfolding and has been continued to unfold, involving Mr. Fairfax, concerning accusations of sexual impropriety and possible crimes. And so we didn't mention that last week. We're not really talking about that this week, but that's part of this Virginia mix of scandal going on. With regard to Governor Northam, his situation seems to go from bad to worse. He's clinging to power. He's refusing to resign. And the interview he gave to CBS was part of his attempt to kind of defend himself and rehabilitate himself. And this campaign has been mixed at best, as evidenced by his indentured servant comments. With regard to the significance of 1619, and of course we're in the 400th anniversary of the year 1619, 1619 is generally reckoned to be the time, marks the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in British North America, when Dutch traders brought 20-odd Negroes, as they're recorded in the records, to Virginia, where they were sold. And so this is generally taken to be the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in British North America. There were undoubtedly enslaved Africans who came to mainland North America previously with the Spanish, but this is the kind of first time that in the records that we know. So it's a notable anniversary, in fact. And indeed, in 2019, in fact, during his State of the Union last week, when President Trump was going through, he was marking the anniversary of D-Day and things like this, I thought, oh, I wonder if he'd be so bold as to mention this. But of course, he was not. So what we see is in 1619, the arrival of these first enslaved Africans in Virginia is their status, the and you know this as well as I do, the number of enslaved Africans in Virginia in the 17th century, for most of the 17th century, is relatively small. We don't get the real influx of large numbers of African slaves in Virginia and British North America really until after 1680, or really 1700. And so their status is rather uncertain in the period before 1700, and historians have engaged in lots of debates about whether enslaved people were really treated the same legally and socially as indentured servants. Indentured servants, of course, were white, mainly British in the 17th century, servants who'd kind of sold their labor in exchange for passage to America. So they were normally committed to become servants, to remain servants after their arrival here in Virginia between 4 and 7 years. And so Northam seemed to be conflating these two things. I don't think he was actually responding to the historiographical debate about the status of Africans in mid-17th century Virginia. He might have been, but I don't think so. This might have been a slip of the tongue. The reason it's elicited a great deal of criticism is because it's coming on the back of the controversy about him wearing blackface and his attempts to, and I think quite sincere attempts on his part, to try and better acquaint himself with the history of race and slavery and its legacy in the state of which he is the governor. But it was a rather ham-fisted way of expressing himself, and it kind of had he not had the history that he's had over the past 2 weeks, and one would argue the past 30 years, this probably wouldn't matter. But it became just another piece of evidence that he doesn't quite understand how resonant slavery and race are, and their legacies are in Virginia and elsewhere. What's your take?
Well, so I've got a few things to say about it. One is to see if I can connect some of our stories here. The 1619 report that mentions the 20-odd Negroes that arrived, that's the phrase from the document, I believe was written by John Rolfe. And John Rolfe, if I'm remembering correctly, was married to a person who was known in Britain as Rebecca, but was originally known as
Pocahontas,
which is what Trump calls Elizabeth Warren. That's my tangential connection between those two stories. So it's a very famous document of reference. What many historians have, especially recently, have pointed out is that doesn't actually necessarily mean those were the first ones in Virginia. It's the first one of the first references we have, and actually the dating of it might be a bit wonky because of the way in which the calendars were established in the early 17th century, in which the new year often fell in March instead of in January. The historiography of this question goes back about the origins of slavery in Virginia and the relationship between slavery and race. You know, it goes back into the in contentious ways into the 1950s. The Hanlons talk about it. Edmund Morgan talks about it, obviously, in American Slavery and American Freedom. Lots of other historians have tried to wrestle with exactly when racial slavery became codified in Virginia in particular. And lots of historians, I think, have looked, and I think this is very true of both the Hanlons and of Edmund Morgan, they look a lot at the legal structures around slavery in Virginia, and they notice that the legal conflation of being black and being enslaved happens in a piecemeal fashion over a period of years in the 17th century, and it's not really, you know, until 1660 or later that you really have a well-defined delineation that makes people of African descent and being enslaved is making those almost identical. The thing that really strikes me thinking about this sort of historiographically is that there is a scholarship from the 50s and 60s that makes it seem almost as if slavery developed almost by accident, right? That racial slavery, you know, was not in a conscious choice by white planters in Virginia, but that sort of fell out of circumstances, but that has to do with demography. It had to do with supply of indentured servants in Britain. It had to do with life expectancy. Part of the problem that early Virginia has is that very few of the people who were transported to Virginia, either voluntarily or involuntarily, lived very long. So if you're an indentured servant or a slave, it didn't really matter because your odds are you're going to die within 6 months. The scholarship takes a turn, I think, in the 70s, and I'm drawing a lot here on Becky Goetz's Twitter feed on this, which I think is really, really great, and sort of sketching out how the historiography changes. There's a really wonderful book that was published, I want to say it's in the 70s, called Mine Own Ground, which examines people of African descent in Virginia, but on the eastern shore of Virginia, so not in the Tidewater, but across the bay. They make the argument in Mine Own Ground that there is a certain sort of flexibility to slavery in Virginia, especially in the early part of the 17th century, and that some enslaved people were managed to acquire their own freedom, the categories were more malleable than they would later become. There's one character in particular that sort of sticks out, and he's often sort of used as a case study for this, a man by the name of Anthony Johnson, who begins his life in the historical record as Antonio the Negro, but then acquires his own, appears first as a slave, becomes free, is able to acquire property, has people that work for him, both free and unfree people who work for him, is able to negotiate certain kinds of economic independence for himself. And one of the things that people have misread that book to say is that, oh, look, slavery wasn't that bad in the early 17th century. Slavery was pretty awful in the early 17th century. But there was a certain sort of flexibility that gets sort of ossified later on.
Yes, the status of indentured servants was also pretty awful in the early 17th century, but that's not to say that slavery wasn't bad.
Oh, yeah, there's a wonderful letter that I sometimes use to teach with, that's a letter from an indentured servant in Virginia back to his parents in England, describing what's like there and begging them to get the hell out of there, because he says, look, I have no shoes, I have no clothes, you know, we're being worked to death, you know, we're starving, we're eating rotten gruel for all of our meals, please get me out of this hellhole.
So, David, one thing to note, Mine Own Ground was written by Tim Breen and Steve Innes.
Yes.
We didn't note that, and it was published actually a little bit later in 1982.
Oh, 82, okay, sorry. Thank you for keeping me honest with my dates.
That's okay.
You know, but some of the scholarship, you know, since then has, especially scholarship that's tried to put, I think, the Virginia in a bigger Atlantic context, I think suggests that English colonizers in Virginia had a fairly clear idea of what black slavery was and how it worked and the kinds of structures and of race and power, and they knew that, you know, in 1619, there wasn't, you know, some of the earlier scholarship seemed to suggest that they really didn't know what slavery was or how to build a slave society. I think some of the more recent scholarship seems to debunk that notion, that, you know, when the 20-odd Negroes showed up in 1619, I think more contemporary scholarship seems to suggest that white colonists in Virginia would have recognized that those were slaves and those were a category distinct from indentured servants, that both black slaves and white indentured servants were unfree of a kind, and that they had certain similarities in the kinds of labor they're being forced to perform, and you know, the kinds of working conditions and living conditions, and that black slaves and white indentured servants are running away together on occasion, but that they were still, they're still very different categories, both legally and socially.
Most crucially, I think, is, as you just said, was the especially the legal category. So although some historians at one time did try to suggest that the status of blacks, enslaved blacks and indentured whites were more or less similar, and I think there were some similarities, the fact remains that their legal status was different.
Yes.
And that difference alone is quite telling, it seems to me. And Winthrop Jordan, in his, you know, classic work White Over Black, now which is 50 years old, you know, long ago, you know, wrote about what blackness meant to Elizabethans and the kind of assumptions associated with that, in establishing the kind of prehistory for this. And so I would agree with you. Do you think, I mean, we're talking about this because of Ralph Northam's slip of the tongue, and I think that's probably what it was. To what extent does this matter, both for him and more generally? You know, why is his use of indentured servants significant? I mean, we know it's wrong. I think we've established that over the past 15 minutes or so. But why does it matter?
Oh, I think it matters for a couple of reasons. One, and it's hard to get inside of his head what he, you know, what he was thinking when he said that. It seems as if somebody mentioned indentured servitude to him at a recent event at Fortress Monroe when they were commemorating this anniversary. But I think it matters partially because I think it's important that political figures have a robust knowledge of both the country they live in and, especially for a state official, the state in which they live and work. You know, I think engaging in politics without knowing the history of the place that you are governing is kind of like acting when you have amnesia. You know, you need to understand how Virginia has ended up the way that it did. And I think understanding the history of race and slavery is so fundamental to the history of Virginia that getting those things right is important. Now, it doesn't mean he needs to be a historian, that he needs to understand the historiography in any great detail. But the fact that, you know, that he didn't know that blackface was a bad thing until quite recently, that's troubling. The fact that he doesn't know, you know, the origins of slavery in Virginia and the sort of, you know, the ways in which it developed, even in a sort of broad outline, I think I find that troubling. If I were an African American in Virginia, I'd be very concerned that my governor doesn't really understand how the people who he is in charge of and has a responsibility for, how, you know, that the social and cultural makeup of Virginia came to be. And so I find that it very important. You know, I'm assuming it was a slip of the tongue, but I think it's symbolic of a sort of broader historical ignorance, and I think that sort of ties in with our third theme today. What do you think, Frank?
I think you're probably right. I mean, I do think it was a slip of the tongue, but in the context of what's going on in Ralph Northam's life in the past couple of weeks, it's a slip of the tongue that he couldn't afford, not just because it's a mistake, but because it does reveal perhaps a larger blind spot for him, which is quite significant in a state which both has this particular history of slavery and quite difficult race relations. And again, that's been revealed by the numerous revelations about various politicians appearing in blackface here and elsewhere. And so I think in that context, this is a problem. You know, words matter, and this is a man who really needs to choose his words carefully in this kind of circumstance. Again, I don't think there was necessarily bad intent on his part in saying indentured servants. And you're right, he seems to have been told this is the term of art at the moment. I don't know who told him that, but that's not correct. But it reveals a perhaps a larger issue with him. I think there's a qualitative difference, however, between Northam's slip of the tongue and Donald Trump's tweet, you know, which seems to reference the Trail of Tears in connection with Elizabeth Warren, which was not a mistake. I mean, that was quite deliberate and meant to be provocative and meant to, you know, that was not an accident, to be sure. And so I think I would make a distinction, I think, between Ralph Northam's use of language and Donald Trump's use of language, which we will get to in a second.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just one final thing before we move on to the Trump comment on Elizabeth Warren. You know, one of the things Northam has said is, look, I'm going to do a program of reading. He has a reading list that he and his staff are going to, books they're going to read together. Some of which are quite old, so it's a bit odd what books they picked. But he's also going to go on a listening and reflecting tour or some other kind of nonsense to talk to people about race in Virginia. I'm all for reading and talking to people, but you should do that before you run for governor, not after you are governor. I think that should be a prerequisite for holding political offices, both, you know, knowing some history and talking to people about the ways in which that history impacts them and the ways in which they understand, you know, their place in society and how it's been constructed historically. You know, that's something you should do 5 years before you're going to run for office, not a year and a half. Once you're in office, after you've gotten yourself in hot water.
Right, sure. I agree with that, David, but I want to push back a little bit on that insofar as let's not forget the man he ran against, Ed Gillespie, was an unrepentant, unreconstructed Confederate apologist. And so in terms of I would rather have Ralph Northam's historical illiteracy than Ed Gillespie's what passes for his historical literacy. I take your point. Yes, would we like people to have a greater awareness of history before they undertake major office? Absolutely. I mean, I think that's our theme today about historical literacy. And he doesn't seem to have that, and that's been revealed. But would I have liked him to have had that before he took office? Yes, I don't disagree with your statement there. But you referred to his listening tour as nonsense. I mean, if he takes this on sincere, what else? If he stays in office, and I think he should resign, but if he stays in office, what else should he do?
Okay, so I know. Maybe I was being supercilious when talking about it as nonsense. But you know, if he's going to stay in office, I also agree he should resign. You know, listening is something he should be doing instead of talking, because clearly talking isn't working well for him. But whenever politicians talk about listening tours, and you know, this is not the first iteration of a listening tour, you know, I'm not always persuaded about how much listening the politician is actually doing and how much of that is a performative measure to appease some part of the constituency that feels they're not being listened to.
Sure. I mean, they always end up going, you know, this listening tour takes them to a very well-lit diner somewhere where they could be photographed doing their listening or talking to people. Yes. But
over an earnest cup of coffee and pancakes, right?
Yeah. Right, but on the other hand, again, to play devil's advocate a little bit, but actually I kind of mean this. What else can he do but go out and listen to his constituents if he intends to stay in office? And to do so, if we give him the benefit of the doubt, surely it must be possible to have a good faith listening tour.
Oh, okay, fine. We'll give him. I'll grant you that. We can give.
You're normally the idealist and the happy one, and I'm the cynic.
Well, the idealist me is he should resign. Actually, ideally, Justin Fairfax should resign first. They should appoint somebody new to be lieutenant governor who's not either a sexual predator or a white supremacist or somebody who accidentally dressed up in blackface. And I have accidentally there in quotation marks. I think they should find somebody. Who is, both qualified to be governor and then, not tainted by scandal, to fill the lieutenant governor's seat, and then the governor should resign, and we should get somebody in there who's, not an embarrassment to the state of Virginia.
I agree, but I'm not sure that scenario will play out. And so that being the case, I think we are where we are, as the cliche goes.
No, I think odds are he's going to try to stick it out. And, I guess if he's going to do a listening tour, that's, good for him. Right. Let's move on to Trump's comment about Elizabeth Warren. Obviously, this is a longstanding trope for Trump that Elizabeth Warren at one point claimed to have Cherokee ancestry, or part of her family was of Cherokee descent. And he, a long time ago, decided to nickname her Pocahontas, who is not Cherokee by any means. Trump conflates all Native Americans together, I guess. But in this most recent comment, Trump, responding to her Elizabeth Warren announcement of her candidacy, talked about seeing her on the trail, and with the trail in quotation marks, many people have seen this as a reference to the Trail of Tears. Right. So, Frank, what do we do with this?
One of the things we do is sort of sigh and bang our heads against the desk, I think, because, well...
That's not good podcasting, Frank.
No, okay. No, it's not. Well, if we do a video podcast, we can do that. You're right. Because we've been here before, and indeed we've discussed elements of this before, I think, on the podcast. Mm-hmm. I think it is – I think there's a contrast to be drawn, as I said a moment ago, between Trump's tweet about this and Ralph Northam's comment, for example, because if we're giving Northam the benefit of the doubt, Trump's tweet was clearly deliberate and deliberately and intended to mock Elizabeth Warren, and in so doing to use Native Americans and to mock Native Americans to mock Elizabeth Warren. And so there's a kind of mean-spiritedness about this, and frankly a racism about this that's quite explicit. And I think we also have to allow for the fact that calling her Pocahontas is racist and sexist in all kinds of ways. And Pocahontas is a tragic figure in a lot of ways historically, but to invoke the Trail of Tears as a joke is pretty heinous because the Trail of Tears resulted in the deaths of – it was the forcible removal of tens of thousands of Cherokees as well as other indigenous nations, the Choctaws and the Creeks and so on, to Oklahoma, and thousands died en route. This is not something one should joke about, frankly. Whether the Trail of Tears was genocide or genocidal is something historians might debate, but the fact that those are the terms of the debate suggests it's not something to joke about. I mean, I have a sense of humor. I like to joke occasionally. When one jokes, one occasionally crosses the line. The president of the United States should know better about this, and in fact, he does know better, but does it anyway because it works with some of his supporters, and it's a way to hammer home this political point, which we might return to, which has been a successful way of attacking Elizabeth Warren. But it's pretty horrendous behavior. That's my response. But as I said, we've been here before. To some extent, it's less shocking. I think it's more egregious behavior than Ralph Northam's statement, Ralph Northam's, comment about indentured servants, but it's also less surprising. With Ralph Northam, you thought, oh, goodness, how could you say that? Come on, man. But with Donald Trump, it's more here we go again. What about you, David?
Well, I mean, just to remind, I imagine most of our listeners are familiar with the Trail of Tears, but just to sort of a brief summary for those people who, were asleep in that lecture. The Trail of Tears comes in the early part of the 19th century. It's after the Indian Removal Act of 1830. Andrew Jackson pushed for moving of Native peoples from east of the Mississippi, most especially the Cherokee, but also the Choctaw, the Creeks, the Seminoles, and the Chickasaws, to what is now Oklahoma, which is then Indian territory. The term Trail of Tears refers specifically to the Cherokee removal from 1838, but it sometimes gets applied more broadly to the removal of all of these Native peoples from the Southeast to what is now Oklahoma. It is an enormous tragedy. The number, the people were forced to leave their homes. They were forced, to leave their property, except for their slaves. They're actually allowed to keep their slaves because that's the early 19th century for you. But thousands died along the way. Thousands more died in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a environmentally a very different location than the hills of Georgia, where the Cherokee were from. So it's a really sort of tragic event. It ties in with Trump's love of Andrew Jackson, who, of course, he has a picture of right next to his desk. He visited Jackson's home at the Hermitage, and it's one of the sort of three defining moments of Jackson's presidency, along with the nullification crisis and the bank war. And I don't know whether Trump doesn't see the Trail of Tears as tragic. He also, in an earlier tweet, mentioned back when I guess Elizabeth Warren had started her run before she officially became a candidate, said she should have done the announcement at Wounded Knee, the site of a massacre of Native peoples in 1890. Mm-hmm. And so, he's specifically mentioning places where Native peoples are being killed in large numbers, in ways that's, to me sounds both racist and tone deaf, but clearly, is done with purpose.
Do you think, is he... we're using this phrase historical literacy. It seems to me that in this case, Donald Trump maybe does have some understanding of the history. We've talked about Trump and Andrew Jackson before and how his view of Jackson is very much rooted in the kind of mid-20th century when he would have gone to school. But, this is deliberate. He knows what he's doing. This isn't like when he read the comment about Frederick Douglass and clearly had no idea who Frederick Douglass was. In this case, I think he's deliberately appropriating a version of this history. You're right. He's doing so in an insensitive fashion because he just doesn't. He certainly doesn't care about indigenous victims of this history. But he's doing it as a way to get at Elizabeth Warren.
Hmm.
And so it's a kind of he's appropriating a particular version of the past. In which. Yeah, basically, he doesn't care about Native Americans. There are a trope he's using or a topic he's using to attack Elizabeth Warren. Not necessarily out of ignorance of the history. At some level, he must understand the history. If he's going to use Trail of Tears as a joke to attack her for claiming Cherokee descent, he knows he knows the Trail of Tears and he associates it with the Cherokees.
Yes. Which, if you know, Elizabeth Warren's, you know, supposed ancestry is Cherokee, so maybe at least he's getting that bit right if he got the Pocahontas bit wrong.
And she was raised in Oklahoma. I mean, there's a connection.
There's a connection there, right. You know, one of the things, though, about the Trail of Tears is there's a white narrative of the Trail of Tears that makes it almost slightly benign. I mean, and you see this when you go to some of the places where the Trail of Tears takes place in Georgia and Western North Carolina. You'll see like historical markers for it, and the way it's described is often like, this is where they, you know, the Native peoples pass through being escorted by the army, but it's not described as a, you know, genocidal act. There's a sort of white memory of it as a sort of banal relocation, which I think is a mischaracterization of what happened. You know, and I think maybe Trump's feeding off of that kind of notion, but it's very hard to tell. I found it hugely offensive, both when he made reference to the Wounded Knee and this reference to the Trail of Tears. And I feel particularly bad for, you know, the Native peoples across the Americas who are sometimes, you know, being in the middle of this political fight between Trump and Elizabeth Warren, because Elizabeth Warren's defenders, you know, try to situate her in a particular way, which also sometimes puts Native peoples in jeopardy. So it's a kind of a mess.
It is a mess. And I mean, one of the, I'm glad you referenced the kind of white interpretation of the Trail of Tears. I think remember there's an essay written many years ago by Francis Paul Prucha, which more or less argues, look, this was the benign alternative to extermination. And so the trail, you know, basically removal was the least bad option. And it's not quite, well, it's a revisionist piece. But I think that's an interpretation that's a lot of people have internalized. As far as, and I completely agree with you about the way Trump deploys Native Americans and their history to attack Elizabeth Warren and how offensive that is. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd ask you to reflect on that in the sense that, do you think it's working? Because my fear is that this kind of strategy of deploying racism to attack Elizabeth Warren is working. I think that Elizabeth Warren is spending far more time talking about this than she intended to. My own sense is that she will not be able to get beyond this. You know, Trump is a very effective bully. He demonstrated that, you know, when he was running for the Republican nomination back in 2016, you know, whether it was little Marco Rubio or low energy Jeb Bush. And, and you know, so this Pocahontas jibe offends, but it also works, not least because he's able to attack Elizabeth. One of the subtexts here that it resonates with is an attack on affirmative action, this notion that Elizabeth Warren somehow got where she is as a professor at Harvard by virtue of lying about her past and invoking this fake Native American heritage of hers to get ahead. And that resonates, I think, with a lot of his supporters. And the racism resonates with some of his supporters. So my fear is this is actually quite an effective tactic, which is why he'll continue doing it.
No, I think the lesson he learned from the last election is, well, I think it's a lesson that he learned many, many years ago, maybe from Roy Cohn and other people that were mentors to him, is the way to rise to the top is not necessarily by being the best person on stage, but by tearing everybody else down and making them, you know, insulting and bullying other people.
I mean, and so, you know, Elizabeth Warren had the DNA test and released that in anticipation of running for president, but that kind of blew up in her face, and certainly the way she handled it, and led to her rightly being criticized by many people from the left. And so I think this is a very effective tactic for him against her.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Native peoples are upset with her because I think her handling of this whole thing has been pretty awful. You know, she hasn't really apologized in a meaningful way for what many Native people see as a kind of white appropriation of their identity. I think there's a lot of anger and resentment there, very well founded. Right, let's see if we can connect all these things with the article in the New Yorker, The Decline of Historical Thinking by Eric Alderman. Frank, you brought this article to my attention. I've let my subscription to the New Yorker lapse. So for those people who haven't had a chance to read it yet, and we'll provide a link in the show notes. Frank, do you want to summarize the main argument here of the New Yorker piece?
Yeah, well, and in fact, I want to thank a listener of ours, Simon from London, who called it to my attention. And Alterman argues, he talks about the fact that history as a discipline and history as a major is in decline in the United States. And this is something that certainly if you spend much time here among historians, one often hears this. And I've spoken to colleagues who teach at often quite prestigious universities here who say that the number of history majors is in sharp decline. And Alterman argues that there's a kind of a lack of historical awareness and historical literacy is a consequence of this. One thing that's interesting that I would observe is that he notes that at elite institutions, and he cites Yale, for example, the number of history majors has either remained steady or increased. And we've certainly seen that at Edinburgh. I mean, the number of history majors in Edinburgh has increased in recent years. I mean, 2008 is normally seen as the key date here. You know, with the last financial crash, history as a major began to decline, and it's gone into steep decline ever since, except at a few elite institutions. And the implication is that history will become a little bit of almost a boutique degree that a few people who already, you know, perhaps already have money can afford to study. And Alterman was looking at the kind of consequences of this.
Yeah, one of the places he points to is University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, which has basically decided to kill its history department in a series of layoffs and reforms. And this is sort of in line with lots of places that are seeing massive declines in enrollment in history degrees, but all of them being sort of, you know, the Harvard and Yale is keeping their history students, but even some very, very good schools who are, one might argue, just as good as Harvard and Yale, but are not quite seeing that the continued popularity of history as a discipline.
In your view, I mean, the reason we kind of linked all these three things together today, David, is because I think that my argument, we would say, listeners would say, well, you would say that, you're historians. But my argument is that the decline of history as a discipline, if it continues on the current rate, has serious implications. You know, Ralph Northam is not a stupid man. Ralph Northam went to medical school. Ralph Northam has had a successful career as a pediatric surgeon. I mean, yet he clearly doesn't know much about history, and we're seeing why that matters, you know, before our eyes at the moment. But if we multiply that by 330 million, the number of people in the United States, potentially, this has serious social implications. Just as a writer, you know, I traveled this week, as you know, and I might mention this later in the show, but so I was on the road, so I had an Uber driver. Oh, you're a historian. I love history. You know, that's what he said. And one hears this all the time when one is out, you know, meeting members of the public. The number of people who say they love history or have an interest in history is quite high. Yet there's this disjuncture because history as a discipline seems to be under threat, and I, for one, think that that has serious social and political implications.
I would agree with you, and I think some of the things he points to in the article are probably some of the underlying reasons for it. I mean, one of it is the cost of higher education in the United States, especially at state universities, has increased. Well, all universities, but has increased pretty dramatically over the past few decades. And so I think, especially after the recession in 2008, lots of parents looked, and college students, looked at a history degree and say, well, that's nice, but how am I going to make that a worthwhile investment, given especially how many people are graduating from university with substantial debt? You know, to what extent can you find employment with a history degree that will pay that off? Now, you and I both know, and I hope our listeners know, there's lots of good things you can do with a history degree that can be, well compensated and other things. But I think a lot of people when they're 18, or lots of parents of 18-year-olds, don't necessarily know that. And they think, oh, well, if you're a history degree, that means you can be a teacher maybe or something else. But the prospects don't look as good as going to into business or going into the sciences or some other field where the employment opportunities may be at least clearer. So I think that's part of the issue with the recent decline, is that simply there's a financial pressure to graduate from university with a degree that is career ready. One of the points that David Blight, who's one of the historians they interview in the piece, one of the points he mentions is that university education has never been just about career employment or career preparation. It's always been about preparation for engagement in the civic sphere as well. And so part of the reason why a history degree is important is because of its role in the making people informed citizens, making people informed voters, making people informed politicians if they choose to do that with their lives. One other cause, I think, for the decline in the history degree in the United States that he doesn't mention has to do, I think, actually with No Child Left Behind, the education reform passed under George W. Bush, which created all kinds of standards for testing in especially primary school for reading and mathematics. And one of the things that's happened over the past 20 years is a fairly significant drop in the number of hours of history and social studies education students get before they get to high school. And I see this especially for people who are high school teachers now. The students are coming in not knowing nearly as much as they did 20 years ago, simply because they haven't been exposed to it, because the priorities in the elementary level have been so heavily focused on math and reading. And so I think that has siphoned off a large number of people who got a love of history early on in previous decades, haven't had that same kind of exposure at sort of critical times that they used to.
Yeah, I mean, the emphasis, such as it is all on STEM subjects, and history is seen as a kind, almost as a sort of, a luxury, an add-on.
So we here at Edinburgh haven't had any shortage of history students, and I get the impression that British universities more broadly aren't having the same dramatic declines that American universities are. What do you attribute that to, Frank?
I have to confess, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the Edinburgh circumstance might be better than that of, we might be in a more advantageous position than some other British institutions because of our size and scale, but also because we're frankly an elite institution. And so we might be benefiting in the way that some elite institutions in the U.S. have. I'm not sure history numbers are holding up at slightly less competitive institutions. But I do think that one of the things that benefits us is the fact that our majors really do major in a subject. So in the final years, they just take that subject. And in English universities, they take the one subject or two subjects they're majoring in or double majoring in throughout their degree. And so students, I think, are better able to really immerse themselves in the subject. They have to know what they want to major in when they arrive to a large extent.
And I think that's a big difference.
So they commit rather than pick and choose. And so they've had a discussion with their parents already about majoring in history before they made an application. So it's not as though they're going home at the end of, you know, for Thanksgiving at the end of the, you know, during their freshman or sophomore year in the U.S. and saying, I'm thinking of history. And, you know, their drunk uncle says, what are you going to do with a history degree? That those discussions aren't happening. They may be happening, but the decision making process is different with us in terms of in Britain when they decide to major in history. So the ones who are applying to do history want to do history. They're not speculating about that at that point.
Yeah.
I think the school education is different. I mean, I've got some concerns about the way history is taught in schools in the UK, but it is taught in schools. It still remains an important part of the curriculum. So I think that helps to explain it. So I think I wouldn't extrapolate too far from Edinburgh's numbers holding up, because I think that might be slightly deceptive. But I do think there are some structural differences that help to explain that difference. What do you think?
Well, I would agree with the fact that, you know, one of the things that keeps our numbers stable is that students get admitted to degree programs when they apply. So, you know, our numbers don't fluctuate as much year from year as American schools do.
I mean, I know, for example, sorry to interrupt you, David, that there's an elite American institution that I know very well, where they lose history majors to business all the time.
Sure.
You know, so kids come in intending to do history, but then they switch over to the business major.
Which is easier to do in American school than it would be in a British school.
Exactly, exactly.
And I think the other bit that's different is that, you know, in Scotland, Scottish students go for basically free because of the way that funding works, and that English students go to English universities and to Scottish universities for £9,000, which is not nothing, but it's a lot less than what a lot of American students are paying. And so they sort of the debt burden sometimes, I think, is maybe a little bit more manageable here in terms of thinking about career things. But part of, I think, the bigger argument in the article is about sort of what this is, this lack of historical education does for the politics and sort of the political culture more broadly. What did you think of the argument there?
I found that persuasive. I think it's correct that, you know, the lack of historical knowledge and the lack of historical literacy means that we have uninformed people making policy that has no reference, not just to, you know, well, to the past, but our understanding of even previous policy. So I think it's hugely significant. What about you?
I would tend to agree that you know, understand history is important to political discourse. You know, there are some declensionist models that say, "Ooh, Americans used to know their history better," and I think the evidence doesn't really support that. I think Americans, some fragment of them, know their history very well, and some fragment, larger fragment, maybe doesn't. You know, so I'm not sure I buy into a declensionist model of you know, a historical golden age when everyone was deeply read in American history, and now everyone's, you know, couch potato. I don't think that's true necessarily. But I think of the political leadership class in the United States, I think we're at a moment where there are lots of them that are not very well read in history, that is not in keeping with the American political tradition. That you know, people have considered themselves you know, candidates for president or people who have been in Congress, I think for the most part have been, over the past 200 plus years, been moderately well read in the nation's history and in history more broadly. and the current occupant of the White House and a few other politicians seem to be significantly less well-read than some of their predecessors. So I may have a declensionist model in that regard.
Yes, although I guess I think you're right about that. I agree completely. Barack Obama, there's a wonderful book that Steve Sarson, who's an Americanist, he's a British academic, but he lives and works in France, that Steve wrote last year, published last year, called Barack Obama, American Historian. It looks really closely at Obama's understanding of and use of American history in his rhetoric and writings. And Steve argues quite persuasively that President Obama really had a not just a passing understanding of American history, but a really deep understanding of American history. So I think we have that kind of understanding at one end of the spectrum, and then perhaps Donald Trump at the other. Mm. And most members of Congress and members of the judiciary and governors like Ralph Northam fall somewhere on the spectrum between the two. I think at the moment we have more towards the sort of end of the spectrum. I'm not saying that everyone agrees, all these people agree with Trump, but I mean in having a kind of superficial understanding of American history rather than a deep understanding of American history, let alone world history or the history of republics. A lot of these people should actually be reading about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. So I think that I would agree with you that that's a problem. And again, we have a tendency to romanticize the past. Poltroons in office and everything else. But, John Marshall wrote a 5-volume biography of George Washington while he was maintaining his judicial career.
And we've had two presidents who were president of the American Historical Association. And there was a point not that long ago, I think, in which one of the reasons why people got a degree in history was they saw that as a route, as a preparation for a political career. I've talked to people who were politicians in the 70s and 80s, and they almost invariably say, I majored in history or political science because I wanted to be prepared for doing that kind of work. And they saw historical training as being part of that apprenticeship. And I don't think you're seeing that nearly as much anymore. Both for people who are thinking about entering politics, but also among history students. I don't see a huge number of them thinking that or seeing their degree as being a prerequisite for or a precursor to a political career. But maybe I'm just not looking in the right places. Or maybe they'll surprise me and I'll become wonderful legislators in a decade or two.
Let's hope so.
We will see. We need the young people to lead us out of this morass.
But those young people need to major in history.
Yes. Yes, they do. Because history matters. All right. So last drops, Frank, what you got?
Oh, I want to praise our alumni. As I suggested a few minutes ago, I was on the road earlier this week. I had to travel to Nashville, Tennessee, to visit Vanderbilt University, and it was my first time in Nashville, which was great. I can highly recommend it. But I met one of our history graduates, in fact, a history alum while I was out there, who's now doing a PhD at Vanderbilt in history. And she was she was a wonderful student when we taught her, David, and I know you taught her as well. But she has just blossomed, and it was so impressive. I've encountered another history graduate here in Charlottesville who, again, was one of our students in Edinburgh, who's now doing a PhD here at the University of Virginia. And she's incredibly impressive. And I just want to give a shout out to University of Edinburgh alumni, because I encounter them a lot when I'm on the road as part of my university responsibilities. And they are invariably great people. So they
make us look good.
They do. Our job is just not to screw them up, really. And as long as we don't do that, we're okay. Congratulations and a shout out to University of Edinburgh graduates, especially history graduates in the context of our discussion today.
Yes, you can go from here to doctoral study all over the world. Great.
What about you, David? What's yours?
I want to endorse something that's Well, it's a television program from 50 years ago.
Cutting-edge stuff, David. Cutting-edge.
Yes. Well, you know, people that may have missed it. So this was from the – it's a episode of Star Trek. And for those of you who don't know, both Frank and I are Star Trek fans, this is from the original series. This is season 3, which is for those of you who are Star Trek nerds. This is not the best of the 3 seasons of the original series. This is the season that has Spock's brain and other kinds of awfulness in it. But the episode I want to recommend is one of the good episodes from that season. And it's an episode called The Savage Curtain, which aired on March 7th, 1969. And what I want to recommend, or the reason why I'm recommending it today, is that this is an episode in which a sort of godlike figure transports the crew of the Enterprise to this planet where they're going. He's going to find out whether good or evil is stronger. And so they bring Kirk and Spock to this planet, but they also bring an important Vulcan named Surak, who is the father of Vulcan civilization, and they bring Abraham Lincoln there. And they fight against Genghis Khan and some other awful people to decide who is whether good or evil is stronger. And the reason why I'm recommending it today is today's Abraham Lincoln's birthday. And the fact that Abraham Lincoln shows up in an episode of Star Trek, I think, is amazing. Spoiler alert, just like in real life, he dies at the end. Lincoln gets, I think, stabbed in the back with a spear or something. But it's a really wonderful episode. He has some very interesting things to say about Lieutenant Uhura when he encounters her. But just thinking about what it means to make an episode of Star Trek you know, in 1969, features Abraham Lincoln with the awful special effects and everything else is worth watching. It's a really, really good episode.
Excellent. So everybody get on Netflix and find it.
Watch old Star Trek because it's just great stuff. All right. Till next week, Frank.
Okay. Cheers, David.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.